Many years ago, I was learning with a young fellow, not yet from. He was a bright young man, and we were learning Chumash. And we were learning Shmos, and we were learning through the Makkos. It was close to Pesach. And at a certain point, he said to me, "This is amazing, the blood, the frog. If God would show me one miracle, just one miracle, I'd believe." I didn't say this at the time, but I believe what he said underscores something that many, many people believe. If I would see one nace, one clear miracle, it would change my emuna. I'd be a totally different person. And I'd like to share with you, I don't believe it's true. I don't believe it's true at all. You can see a miracle, you can stare right at a miracle, and it won't budge you an iota. And probably the greatest demonstration of that is the Mitzrim. The Mitzrim lived through a year of Hashem's direct revelation, showing himself totally and completely as the creator and master of everything in creation. And they didn't become Bali Tshuva. You didn't hear about the Or Sameach Mitzri Egyptian branch. They didn't all fall on their face and say Hashem Elokim, quite the opposite. Almost to a man, they rebelled, they fought, and in fact, in the very end, they chased the Jewish people to their death into the Yam Suf. So here's the point. They lived through miracles. They lived through overt, obvious miracles, and they didn't believe. But I want you to understand, it's not just they lived through miracles. You have to remember, Hashem is Kol Yochel. Hashem could do anything that Hashem wants at any given time. Hashem is the master of all of creation. Hashem could have taken the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim in any manner, shape, or form. Hashem could have airlifted us out. Hashem could have made every Mitzri die by Magay for some plague, COVID. But that's not what Hashem did. Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu, "I want you to go to Paro, and I want you to do these things because I want you, I want the children of Israel, and I want the children afterwards to know, Esther Salalti b'Mitzrayim, that I played with the Mitzrim." Meaning to say, Hashem was demonstrating his control over every facet of creation, and each one of the Makkos was a further revelation, a further demonstration of Hashem's mastery over every particle of this world. And you have to understand something. Hashem is not in the miracle business. The Ramban explains that one time in history, one time Hashem showed himself, and that was to be forever the siman, the os that we refer back to. The reason why we have so many mitzvahs that circle back, that remind us about Yetzias Mitzrayim, is because that was the one time in history that Hashem revealed himself and was supposed to constantly remember it, constantly view it, constantly relive that moment. But the point is, the Mitzrim lived through that very moment. The same thing that we sit each Pesach Seder night and we retell and retell over and we say it in Shema, we have mezuzah and we have tefillin and 19 mitzvahs that remind us about the fact that Hashem saved us, took us out of Mitzrayim. The Mitzrim lived through that and they didn't become Bali Emuna. They didn't fall on their face and say Hashem Elokim. But if you're not appreciating yet quite how astonishing this is, let's focus on what it was like to be a Mitzri in Mitzrayim at the time. Now again, you've lived there your whole life, and you've heard various Avodah Zarah, various gods, my God, your God, the other God, and suddenly these two very tall Jewish people show up in Paro's court. How they appear is very miraculous, because you can't just walk into the king's court, but they walk into the king's court, and suddenly they appear. You have to recognize, Moshe Rabbeinu was majestic. There was a Torah, beauty and power about him. Aaron was the same. And they made an incredible impression. But you have to understand what the Ramban tells us, that from the very first meeting, Paro knew he was outclassed. Hashem gave the three oaths, the three signs, and one of which was to take the stick and throw it on the ground. Moshe Rabbeinu takes the stick, throws it on the ground, and what happens? Paro calls the Mitzri kids out, "You do it too." They do it. And then Aaron picked up the stick and had his stick, thrown it down, and his stick ate all of the serpents that the Mitzrim had created. At that point, Paro realized he was outclassed. What if he tells that staff to swallow me and my throne up? And if you'll notice, from that point on, no longer did Paro ever say the words, "Who's this Hashem?" until that point, who is this Hashem? I've never heard of him. But from that moment on, Paro understood with whom he was dealing. And you'll notice, even though he was obstinate, and even though he many times he reneged, but from that point on, he realized that he was dealing with the creator of the heavens and the earth. But from that point on, no one changed, not Paro nor anyone else. And let's understand, let's take a moment only to focus on what it was like. So imagine that Moshe Rabbeinu warned Paro day after day. Each Makkah had 7 days of warning. And he comes into the palace and says, there's going to be a plague. All of the water and all of Mitzrayim will turn into blood. For 7 days he says that, day after day. Finally, the day happens and all of the water and all of Mitzrayim turns into blood. But blood is thick. Water is thin. All of the fish died. Everywhere there was a stench, and nowhere could a Mitzri drink water unless he paid a Jew for it. But the Mitzrim were living through that. Now imagine you're Muhammad or you're Anwar, and you're standing there by the Nile, and you watch the entire Nile River, miles wide, turn into blood, thick blood, that all the little fish begin floating because they can't breathe, they all die. And anywhere you go, any water that you stored suddenly turned into blood. But you're living through this, you're experiencing it. And you're seeing clearly, as we discussed last week, one reality, that water is clear, odorless, and tasteless, not because Hashem created it at one time, but because Hashem created it and maintains it that way. And the minute that Hashem deems it to be otherwise, that water becomes thick, globulous, it smells, has a stench to it, and it's red blood. Because everything in creation was not just created by Hashem, but is maintained by Hashem. Now we spoke about this last week at a very high level of Emunah, and we may never attain that full cognition that everything in existence is held in existence by Hashem. A rock means Hashem is there keeping it. Anywhere there is anything, that means Hashem is there. That for us is something that's important to be aware of, but way, way above our madrega. The problem is the Mitzrim lived it as a reality. They experienced it. It wasn't theory. It wasn't some Musa shmuz. It was something they saw right in front of them in a very real, palpable way. They took a cup of water they were holding and it turned into blood, and that's how it remained until the Mitzri took that cup and gave it to the Jew, and it went from blood to water. And when the Jew gave it back, it went water to blood, blood to water, until the Mitzri paid for it, and then it remained water. What a Mitzri saw with absolute clarity of vision was that water is kept in its existence as it is by Hashem at any given moment, and the minute Hashem deems it to be otherwise, it instantly changes. But let's go on. Each of the Makkahs lasted approximately a month. There were 3 weeks of warning, and each Makkah was about 1 week in length itself. Let's deal with the next Makkah, Sfardea. The story is told that someone once saw the Chafetz Chaim being Maver Sedra. It was in the Parshas of Shmos, and the Chafetz Chaim started laughing. And someone said, what does the Shiva find so funny about the Chumash? So Chafetz Chaim said, I was just reading about this Makkah. Imagine big King Paro, important man, sitting on his throne, and all of a sudden the frogs jumping. It was very funny. I started laughing. And if you think about it, it is comical. Frogs are not attack animals. Frogs are just annoying. But if you understand what Hashem was saying was, we're not equals. We're not waging war over here. And Midrash tells us that one Svardea, one frog, came out of the Nile. A big frog came out of the Nile and began a beeline straight for Paro's palace. And when the guard saw it, the guard smashed it. That frog split into two. So they hit the other one, split, until the entire Mitzrayim was filled with frogs. Now the Stipe Lagon asks a very important question on this. He says, wait a minute. You hit this frog and it split. Something's going on. You hit the next one and it split. You hit the next one and it split. Stop! Just stop! If there were 16 frogs in Mitzrayim, it's a mighty big land. 16 frogs is not going to cause that much of a problem. Why didn't they just stop? And the stifler answers, these frogs are so annoying, they jump on you, get out of here, yeah, couldn't help but smack it, smack it. Before you knew it, they multiplied and multiplied and multiplied. The entire land was filled with frogs. Now, folks, don't try this at home. But I guarantee you go into the swamp with a stick and smash Kermit, you're not going to get a split. You're going to get a squish. But these frogs were not regular frogs. Hit split until the entire Mitzrayim was filled. Wherever you went, on the chairs, on the leg, wherever you couldn't sleep at night, there was a loud ruckus, ribbit, 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 ribbit. You lie down in your bed, ribbit, ribbit, ribbit. But the Midrash tells us it wasn't just in the beds, it wasn't just in the closet, it wasn't just everywhere you went. They would jump into the ovens and they would jump into the throats of people, and miraculously, Hashem would allow these frogs to remain alive in the stomachs, and you could hear them croaking. For 7 days, the Mitzrayim were plagued by Sardeia from inside their stomach, in their house, wherever they were, these frogs were there. You couldn't sleep, you couldn't... Okay, now imagine Muhammad has lived through already 1 month of Dan, and now comes this Sardeia, this plague, and he says, this is absurd, I am not going to do it. I saw what happened to that last guy. He opened his mouth and a frog jumped down his throat. It's not going to happen to me. Day one, he sits there eating his cereal with his teeth clenched. Lunch is okay too. Supper's all right. That frog is not getting down my throat. He tries to lie down at night, but there's frogs, right? He can't barely sleep. He's tired. He's wiped out. 2 days, 3 days into it. On the third day, he sees, uh-oh. He goes left and the frog goes left. He goes right and the frog goes right. He goes back and a frog goes back. Oh my goodness, I'm being stalked by Kermit. You're not going to get me. You're not going to get. And Kermit jumps down his throat, and for the next 4 days, from his stomach, ribbit, ribbit, ribbit. Do you understand this is not normal? This is not just COVID unusual. This is highly, highly unusual. And then exactly at the time when Moshe Rabbeinu said it would happen, he drew a line on the wall. When the sun gets to this line, that's when the Makkah will stop. As soon as the sun got to that line, the entire Mitzrayim, which was a loud ruckus of croaking, 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 stopped, dead silence. And now there were piles and piles and piles filling everywhere of dead frogs. All over, wherever you were, piles and mountains and piles. You couldn't move. The stench was unbearable. And then began the warning for the next 3 weeks. Day after day, Moshe Rabbeinu would come into the palace and warn, there's going to be another Makkah. Let the Jewish people go. Let the Jewish people go. If you don't, there's going to be kinim. Now, kinim don't sound very egregious. I mean, kind of little lice. Help, little lice. Well, these little lice, they just love to dig their little legs into your hair follicles, and they just love to dig in. And the lice were 3 tefachim deep. They were land debates between Mitzrayim and the various countries surrounding whether this land belonged to which country. Every land issue was settled because all of the dirt in all of Egypt turned into lice 3 tefachim deep. You dug with a shovel, you didn't get dirt, you got lice. But it was only the land in Mitzrayim. Any land that was outside of Mitzrayim didn't turn to lice. So you could see the border, as it was cut by a laser. You could see exactly the border of Mitzrayim. If there was lice, it was Mitzrayim. If there was no lice, it was outside Mitzrayim. And again, each Mitzri there lived through 7 days of just scratching. You can't sleep, you can't move, you can't eat. It's not life-threatening. Es asher salalti Mitzrayim. Hashem says, I'm going to play with them, toy with them, until they realize. But they didn't realize. Now we're 3 months deep into this. If each Makkah between the warning and the Makkah itself, the warning 3 weeks and the Makkah is 7 days, about a month for each Makkah, we're 3 months into this. And at this point, the Mitzri economy has stopped. Because for 3 months, no one is working the fields. Much of the crops had died because all of the water turned to blood. Much of the anything that had to be done couldn't be. And then we go on, Makkah after Makkah. Arba, let's deal with one that I really love, Borod. What I love about Borod is two things. Number one, the next time you're driving in the summer and you hear the tinkle, tinkle, tinkle of a little hail storm. You ever get those, you know? So you put up the radio louder because it's, you know, you don't want to be disturbed. That's not what Barad is. Barad was softball-sized blocks of ice with fire inside. The ice would come crashing down and break open, and the fire would burn whatever was left in the field to burn down. Now, you may ask the question that water and fire can't coexist. Either the water extinguishes the fire or the fire causes the water to evaporate, but they don't coexist. Rashi answers that question by saying, Asu Shalom, they made peace. Because of the miracle of Bara, they made peace. Now you have to understand something. Moshe Rabbeinu warned Paro, bring in all of the crops, bring in all of the sheep, bring in all of the livestock, bring in any servant you have. Because anyone in the fields, anything alive in the fields will be destroyed. Because these are going to be bombing down from the heavens, softball-sized blocks of ice. Any living creature in the fields will die. And interestingly enough, what does the Pasuk say? Hayore devar Hashem. Those who feared Hashem's words brought their animals in. Vashelo sam libol is there, but the other ones who didn't listen left their animals out in the fields. Now you have to understand the rank stupidity of this. You're dealing with your livestock. You're dealing with your slaves. You're dealing with what you own. Why don't you bring them in? I'm not accepting those words. I don't believe this Moshe. I don't believe this God stuff. And the midstream people, by and large, did not accept what their eyes were showing them. They denied and denied. And you go on makkah after makkah. Now, after a certain point, the midstream economy was devastated. Their wealth was in their livestock, in their crops. Everything was gone. Everything was destroyed. They went from being the prime power of their time to being devastated. And they were witnessing this month after month. Makkah of Choshech, absolute complete darkness. But not darkness, not simply dark. Dark is dark. You can't see, you fumble around. Dark means so dark that they couldn't move. Now I remember my son asking me the question, why don't you just move? The Medrash tells us if you climbed up a ladder and it's suddenly Choshech, that's where you stayed. Why don't you just move? Sit down. Why are you stuck up there? Just sit down. It's dark. You can't see. But you can find the floor. The Ramban explains that the air took on a new dimension. It was a thickness to the air, almost like jello. You could... It was so thick. So that's when my son asked me to kasha. So how did Mitzri even breathe? It's so thick. That's a nice miracle. But here's the point. Every Mitzri was there when the very thin air turned into thick, substantial globular stuff. You can't move. You can't. They lived through this. Moshe warned it's going to happen, and it happened. Now, by the final Makkah, by Makkah's Bechoros, you have to understand that the Mitzrim got it. At least the Bechoros, the firstborn, got it. And they made a campaign. They showed up at Paro's palace and said, let the Jewish people go. This is insane. They're killing us all. We're all going to die. And every one of the Bechoros, every one of the firstborn, knew that they were on the chopping block. And they said to Paro, you have to let him go. And Paro said, no. And it was a civil war. Paro put down the rebellion and said, no. And in fact, exactly, b'chatzosa laila, exactly at the stroke of midnight, every firstborn in Mitzrayim died. But interestingly enough, the Pasuk says, ein bayis asher ein sham meis. There wasn't a single house that didn't have a dead person in it. Now here's the problem. What if they didn't have children? Don't worry about it. The oldest person there died. There were nuclear families. There was an Uncle Bob and an Uncle Joe. Uncle Bob was 82. Uncle Joe was 84. Uncle Joe died. The oldest male died in the house. Rashi explains there were some houses where many people died. The Mitzri women were promiscuous. So a Mitzri woman might have had a firstborn to this man, another firstborn to that man, another firstborn to that man. Rashi says there were some Mitzri houses where five children died. Five children died. Every single Bechor, every Bechor of the behemoths, of the animals, every Bechor Adam died on the spot. But you have to appreciate what was happening here. Imagine that you're Cleopatra and you see five of your children die. Five of your children dead. And you say to yourself, oh my goodness, 25 years ago I met this guy in whatever. No one knew about it. I had a child from that child's dead. 5 years later, this fell. No one knew. No one saw. and that child's done. And 5 years after that, she watched five of her kids die. What she saw clearly was that someone was there. Someone was watching. Hashem was watching, recording, visiting now the just revenge to that action. But she saw it with her own eyes. If you'd like to understand how foolish the mitzvah were, imagine that we get to watch Cleopatra. And at the funeral, she goes to the cemetery and she buries her five sons. And she turns to her friends and says, "Girls, girls, look, five of my children died. Please be careful with your health. Watch, please, no red meat. Please, please be careful." That would be absurd. But that's effectively what the mitzvah did. Why? Because no sooner did the Jewish people leave after Makas Bechor, "Get out of here, get out." They left. And Paro saw after 3 days they're not coming back. Paro mounts his rechev. He leads the charge. And they charge out after the Jewish people. Now you have to appreciate at this point, something's going on. Okay, granted Hashem was hichpidus libo. Hashem made their heart heavy. First of all, during the first five Makos, most of the Rishonim explain Hashem did not influence their choice at all. But even after the fifth Makkah, by the sixth Makkah, Hashem made his heart heavy. The Surah explains what that means. There was such an overwhelming, powerful sign that Hashem was in charge. It was like Hashem's foot was right there. Paro had no free will. He had no free will to resist. When Hashem hardened his heart, he brought him back to equilibrium that he had the power to resist. But never did Hashem take away the free will. Yet they chased the Jewish people into the Yam. Now, before the Jewish people actually went into the Yam, remember, Ane covered powerful pillars of cloud that were leading the Jewish people, came behind the Jews and stopped the Mitzrim there. Now, next time you're in a plane and you go through those fluffy little clouds and you see the nice little fluffy pillowy kind of things, think about an Anan covered. An Anan is a cloud. But this Anan covered was so powerful, the Mitzvah would charge, they couldn't get through it, they fired arrows, nothing penetrated, and they stood there the whole night. But listen to what the Ramban said. When it was time for Kriyas Yamsuf, and the Pasuk says that Hashem split the sea with Ruach Kadim Aza, with an eastern wind, Kol HaLaila, the entire night. And the Ramban explains actually what happened. And the Jews are camped against the Yam, the Mitzrim over here, the Anan between them, and a wind starts blowing, a powerful eastern wind starts blowing across the sea. And the wind gets stronger and stronger, and suddenly it starts digging out a little bit of the water. Furrow here, a furrow here, a furrow here. And then the wind gets stronger, and the furrows get deeper, and they get deeper, and they get deeper. And suddenly they open up wider and wider. And hour after hour, the furrows get wider and deeper until after hours and hours, you have the entire Yam split into 12 distinct parts. And at that point, the Anan that was stopping the Jewish people lifts up and the Jewish people enter the Yam. The Mitzrim are still held back, but the Mitzrim are able to see the Jewish people in the Yam. When the Jewish people get to about midpoint in the Yam, they're walking on bedrock. They're walking on, normally it's muck and mire, but now it's nice and smooth and very, very firm. And when they get to about the middle of the Yam, at that point the Anan covered that was stopping the Mitzrim, lift up, and what did the Mitzrim say? "Charge, let's get them!" And they charge into the 12 different channels to chase down the Jewish people. Now the Rambam points out that is not very sane. And he points out that how is it possible they did that? So he explains that they were tola on the wind. You see, the reason why Hashem split the Yam with an eastern wind is because Hashem wanted to give them the chance to hang their hat on something. And they said, you see, it's the eastern wind. The wind split the Yam. It's not God. Explains Ramban, even though the eastern wind doesn't normally split the sea into 12 parts, and certainly not when you're chasing your enemy and not just conveniently to allow them. Even so, they didn't pay attention to that. Machmas rov tavosam l'ralahem, because of a tremendous desire to hurt the Jewish people. And they charged into their death and died on the Yam. So here's the question. How is it possible? Let's make the assumption that the Mitzrim were normal, rational, sane people. Let's make the assumption that they were as intelligent as you and I. How is it possible that they could do this? And the truth be told, I don't know if we could answer this question if it weren't for the fact that we live through such a phenomena today. But first, let me answer the question at least in theory, and then we'll see how it applies in our very society. To answer this question, let me ask you a very basic question. And that is, does a malach have free will? Do angels have free will? Now, since you're a little kid in cheder, I'm sure you learned that malachim don't have free will. Adam, man has free will. Angels don't have free will. Free will is relegated to man and man alone. That's, I'm sure, what you learned since you were a little child. However, it's not true. Malachim have free will just like man has free will. There are times when malachim make mistakes and they're punished. An angel has free will. Man has free will. There's no distinction between man and angel in terms of free will. If you'd like to understand the distinction between man and a malach, it's something very different. Do you have free will to put your hand into a fire? Let's say I would offer you $100. Peel up a $100 bill and say, I'll give you this $100 bill if you put your hand in a fire for 1 minute. Do you have free will to put your hand in a fire? The answer is, I mean, in theory you could, but you never would because it's stupid. Not for $100, not for $100,000 because it's self-inflicted damage. You would never do it. Do you have free will? In theory you do, but you never would. That's the kind of free will that a malach has. A malach sees with absolute clarity of understanding that everything that Hashem commanded was for our benefit. Every mitzvah helps me, every avera damages me and damages the world about me. But a malach sees that with absolute clarity of vision. As a result, a malach won't disobey the words of Hashem because it's like my putting a hand in a fire. Does it have free will to do it? Yeah, in theory it could, but it never would. But that's not the way Hashem wanted to create us. Hashem wanted to give us practical free will. And practical free will means that I could choose A, I could choose B, and I'm the one who chooses. But you see, for me to be the one who chooses, it both have to be viable options. And both have to be available. And both have to be possible. But if I were like a malach, I would never have that kind of free will. And therefore Hashem put us into this body, this heavy cloak of physicality that blinds us and darkens our sight and doesn't allow us to see the consequences. But that yet was not quite enough. Hashem added one more dimension, and that's the dimension of imagination. If you've ever read a book, as a kid, if you remember reading a novel, and suddenly you were there as a pirate on the seven seas, and the enemy was boarding your ship, and you pulled out your scabbard, and you began slashing and sweating, and suddenly your mother called you to dinner. Oh, the pirate ended. If you've ever read a novel, if you ever watched, gone to the theater, and been carried away with a story, you see imagination at work. Imagination is this capacity to take something fictional and feel it like it's real. If you ever read a book and you began crying, you know that imagination is at work. Because what's really happening is you're identifying with the story. By the way, in Hollywood, one of the most difficult positions is the casting director. The casting director's job it is to put the right actor into the right role. But it doesn't mean the most handsome actor. It doesn't mean the most talented actor. It's the actor who fits the role best, but more than fits the role, the actor who's credible, believable, and the one with whom the audience will identify. You see, the only way the movie works is if when the actor's going down that dark alley, it's me who's going there. When he rises from cancer and wins the Olympics, it's not him, but it's me. And the reason why you get carried away when reading a novel or watching something is because you're in that event. You're living it, you're feeling it, and any emotions that you feel are because you're experiencing it. And that's imagination at work. And imagination is a powerful, powerful tool. When Hashem put us into this body that darkens and thickens our vision and then gave us imagination, now we have this thing called free will. Why? Because at my whim, I could create entire fanciful philosophies, entire worldviews that make whatever I want to be permitted. If you'd like to see this in operation, that's what the Mitzrim were doing. They did not want to accept Hashem as the creator, the master of the heavens and earth. And no matter what evidence Hashem showed them, no matter how clear it was, day after day, week after week, for a year, it didn't matter. My mind is made up. Don't confuse me with the facts. And no matter how clear it was, Hashem gave a human being the capacity to stare into the ball of the sun and deny its existence. And it's only because we live in this heavy, thick body that allows us to be so illogical. We have this powerful imaginative side to us that allows us to believe exactly what we believe. And human beings do not have to believe what's true. They don't have to believe what's accurate. They can believe anything they want to believe. And if this sounds preposterous, which it really should, it would be if it weren't for the fact that we live through this on a daily basis. In our day and age, when humankind is so sophisticated, has such knowledge, there's a huge, vast number of the population who deny a creator. The world just happened. It happened. A lucky roll of the cosmic dice, and it all came into existence. Now, you have to appreciate that it's kind of a silly theory. When I was a kid, I had a little trouble with my knees. I went to the orthopedist, and he said, "Son, you have chondromalacia patella." I said, "Ooh, is that bad? What does that mean?" "Chondromalacia patella. That means the back of your knee, back of your kneecap, there's some extra cartilage." I said, "Oh, very nice." So as a young boy, I learned that science, and very good at coming up with big titles, big names, fancy names, a lot of times with Latin suffixes, Latin words, it makes it very, very big. You ever notice the theory of it all? The basic theory of everything. Where did everything came from? Everything came from the Big Bang. The Big Bang. Now, when Moshe is a five-year-old kid, and there's a noise outside, "Mommy, there was a Big Bang." Big Bang is not a very sophisticated sounding theory exactly, is it? Okay, so here's basically the theory. Everything that your eye sees wasn't, but there was a Big Bang. I mean, a big bang. It was such a big bang that 100 billion galaxies, each containing 100 billion stars, came into existence in perfect orbits, perfect balance, perfect. This Earth just happened with an atmosphere, with the sun at exactly the right distance, not too close, we'd be toast, not too far, be frigid, tilted at 23.5 degrees, and just because we're three seasons, everything perfectly just happened as is. Okay, good. I got a question or two I'd like to ask. If you bring me your local atheist, I would like to ask at least one question I think is very valid and very worth thinking about. If there's a Big Bang, here's my question. If you have two items in existence, I have a rock and I have a piece of wood, I can bang them together. But I'd like to ask you a very basic question. Before the Big Bang, there was nothing, absence of physicality. What banged against what? You can't create out of nothing something, unless it's a supernatural creation with a creator creating it. But you can't just out of nothing create what banged against what. And if you begin to think about the theory of evolution, you begin to realize the preposterousness of it is beyond description. When you open a science textbook and you read page after page after page of such sophistication, when you read about the vastness of this world and all of the systems integrated, all working together, all harmoniously functioning, you begin to realize that this is so absurd that there aren't words to begin to even express it. But if you're not quite sure, I want to share with you one observation that I think is should really open your eyes to this. It began, I guess, you know, in 1983. It's probably the first time it happened. It was when Microsoft announced Windows was coming out. Now, for those of us who were around in those days, Windows was supposed to be the newest thing. You didn't have to just have one frame open in your computer. You could operate Windows. It was a whole new concept. Okay, anyway, it was 1983. They made the announcement. Windows was going to come out. And suddenly there was a huge delay. It didn't come out. 6 months passed. Another 6 months passed. And finally, 6 months later, after that, Windows was launched. What had happened was, you see, when you write code, it takes a certain amount of time to write code. And they approximated how many hours it would take to write to code, but they were way off. It ended up taking 90 man years, meaning to say it would take a man, let's say a man works 40 hours a week, he works 50 weeks, it would take 90 men an entire year to write the code. There was so much code that needed to be written that it was 90 man years. They had totally misjudged it, and therefore it was months and months late. But here's the point. Computer coding used to be measured in man hours and man years. Now it's in incredibly large numbers. There are certain programs that take thousands of man years, meaning you have a team of 100 or more people writing code, and it takes them 2 years to write all the code, and one on top of another, on top of another, each code written on top of the other. Okay. When the space shuttle was first launched, someone estimated how much coding went into the space shuttle. Now keep in mind, the space shuttle had many systems, a navigation system, life support, you had fuel management, and they approximated that the amount of code that was written, that was used in the space shuttle, was 22,000 man years worth of development. No human being, no one human being could test it all, no one human being could even be aware of it all. Teams and teams and teams of people making sure it was online, because again, the sum total of 22,000 man years to develop it, an astonishing accomplishment for mankind. Okay, what if you were to ask a biologist? Ask a biologist the following question. If you were to compare a human baby to the space shuttle, which is more sophisticated? More sophisticated, crazy? A human baby is so many times infinitely more complex. One cell in the human body is far more complex than the space shuttle. Do you understand what goes on? And you could open a 1,000-page textbook that describes one cell in the human body. Mechanisms and systems and balances and just incredible factories producing chemicals within one cell. And the baby forms within the uterus, and the limbs, the liver, the organs, the eyes, the brain. It all forms without any, no elves putting it together, just forms on its own and comes out a fully formed, beautiful baby, alive, healthy and well. In the womb, the baby doesn't breathe, it would die. As soon as it comes out, it breathes, the heart changes direction. The countless numbers of complications that are involved in birth are beyond description. And you're telling me no one wrote the code, it just happened? The absurdity of it is so beyond description that you can't really deal with it rationally. And I think what this Ramban is sharing with us is a fundamental concept. People believe exactly what they want to believe. And my friend, dental school, that fellow I was learning with back in the day, when he said, if God would show me one miracle, I believe, it's not true. Hashem could show you miracle after miracle that won't cause you to believe. The Mitzrayim saw exactly that. They lived through month after month of Hashem's direct revelation, that which we repeat now year after year as the bedrock of our Emunah. They lived through it, but it didn't bring them to Emunah. Why? Because Hashem created the human being unlike a malach. A malach sees it and has to acknowledge the truth. A human being doesn't have to. I have this sense of imagination. I'm in this heavy cloak of physicality. And in this state, I can believe exactly what I want to believe. I could create the realities I want. And I can stare at the most obvious overt miracle. And I could just say, it just happened. And if it sounds incredulous, how could the Mitzrayim believe that the wind split the arm? It can't be. How could they be so foolish? Just watch a scientist today, a sophisticated man who will tell you such incredible depth of the world. And he'll climb into one small area of this creation and he'll reveal to you things you can't imagine. And then he'll say the word, yep, amazing how nature just evolved. Amazing. What are you playing with a full deck? Are you serious? But they do it. Again, it's just one more example of the fact that when Hashem gave free will, it was a very, very great creation, giving man that capacity to believe exactly what he wants to believe, and not an iota off. And I want to close with one last observation, because this to me was very dear. My daughter, who got married very recently during COVID, was actually born on Yom Kippur. And as a family, at the time, we had a number of kids. And as a family, we were studying the growth of the unborn child, and we had one of these CDs called The 9-Month Miracle, and you could see And he would show you inside the uterus what the babies were up to at different stages, the limbs forming. And for us as a family, it was a tremendous chizik in Amunah. In any case, it turns out it's Yom Kippur, and my wife is very near the due date. And anyway, she starts having contractions. She calls the doctor. The doctor says, you better get down there. I had it all arranged with the guy to do the cab, the whole routine. Bottom line is, it's too late. I ended up driving my wife on Yom Kippur, driving it to the hospital, doing a lot of speed, getting there. 20 minutes after we got to the hospital, she gave birth, Baruch Hashem, to a healthy baby girl. Now you have to imagine, this is Yom Kippur, I'm still fasting. I'm wearing my whole Yom Tov garb, and I'm in the delivery room, and I see this healthy baby come out, and I was just filled with joy, with simcha, with appreciation. I wanted to say Hallel, and I said something like, what a miracle, wow. And the nurse next to me said, yes, isn't it amazing how things evolved? I wanted to grab her. I wanted to, what are you, lady, you just participated in one of the greatest miracles in this creation. You were part of it, and you just evolved. But that is exactly what the Mitzrim did, and that's what we do as well today. We live through miracles, and we have bodily functions. We eat, we have such sophisticated bodies, and we ignore the simple reality that Hashem created and keeps it going. We live through miracles. Mitzrim lives through miracles. Unless you open your eyes, unless you open your mind and say, let me understand, and let me rationally, clear-headedly think this through, you don't have to believe it. But when you open your eyes and you ask yourself, what does my mind tell me? Forget my agenda. Forget my what it's going to cost me or what it's going to mean. What do my eyes tell me? You'll see Hashem right there. You'll see a creator, because that is the most obvious thing that a thinking human being can see. And that is what I have to say on this subject. And now I'd like to open the floor to questions, thoughts, observations. You can, if you're shy, you can write the questions in, or you can be brave and raise your hand. If you want to raise your hand, if you have a question, it could be on the Mitzvah, it could be on Emunah, it could be on science today, it could be on any topic you like. Okay, please feel free to write in a question. Some questions I'm going to choose to answer privately. The question about the Rav, etc. Ask me that quietly, please, and I'll try to answer that. I don't think it's for a public forum. Okay, Ronnie, you have the floor. I hope you do. I think you do. Yes.
Hi, Rabbi.
Hi, how are you?
Baruch Hashem. So in that case, when that woman was saying, do you know how to just evolve? Should you say something, or should you, because maybe you should be defensive? There's many cases where, I had a professor, and one time he's like, oh, you see how this proves there's no God?
Oh, so right.
Mm-hmm. Pick up in the class, should I say something? What do you do with these types of cases?
It's a famous story. It was in Russia. My Russian, I'm going to do it in English. But anyway, the teacher calls out, Tommy, do you see God? No. Sally, do you see God? No. Bob, do you see God? You see, that proves that God doesn't exist because you don't see him. So little Tommy says, Bob, Sally, do you see the teacher's brain? No. That proves the teacher doesn't have a brain. What can I tell you? Meaning, you're not going to win. The reason why you're not going to win is because I believe what I want to believe. I don't believe. See, if a person is dispassionate, a person is intellectually honest, and is asking, let me know the truth. I don't care. Whatever the agenda, whatever happens, I just want to know the truth. It's very easy to explain, to show them Hashem's hand, Hashem as the creator. But that's not what happens in your classroom. That's not what happens when you meet people. They're not asking you, I want to know, I'm open-minded. They're convincing you of their position. You want to convince, there's no dialogue, no debate. All that's happening is they're not open, they're not interested, they're not listening. So you're basically wasting your time. So you say something like that, very nice, onward. Because you're not going to win that fight. So no, certainly at that point there, it wasn't the time for it, and it wasn't something I was interested in debating at that, certainly not at that point. All right? Okay. Right. Okay. Yehuda, you have the floor now. I believe you do. Yeah. No. Yehuda, do you have the floor? Yehuda, I think you have the floor. No? Yeah, I think you do. Yes. Do you? No? They're not ready. Yes. Grace Sadik, you have the floor. Is that true? Nobody has the floor. The rabbi is not ready. You do? Ah, Shalom Aleichem Edward, how are we doing?
You hear me?
I hear you, but I hear Yehuda also.
Yeah,
Wait, I hear two people. That's the problem. The rabbi is clearly technologically challenged. Let me, Yehuda, let me, I'm not getting a clear signal from you, so we're going to give Edward a chance, and then I'll come back to you, okay? Okay, Edward, you have the floor, I believe. I believe you do.
Yeah, again, delivery of the baby. I saw God because I was in the room when my wife delivered the baby. And you know what happened? I was watching Terminator by Schwarzenegger in the same room. And when she stopped delivering the baby and the baby was out, it was like a torpedo out of her. I fainted. And the last word I heard, my wife was screaming, "My husband, my husband!" I was completely failing because I was like in the alien movie. It's like unbelievable. When I woke up, I thought like I'm in space or something. It was, and after that, you can say, what evolves, evolved, whatever. So you just remind me of this. And it was in the blizzard in 1996.
Uh-huh.
If you, everybody was trapped in the hospital and I slept on the floor, the whole city was trapped.
I hear.
Okay. So my some observation and the question.
Yes.
My daughter, who was delivered, and she was in yeshiva for some time, but she was in the school, Mark Twain school, for gifted and talented. And they had a lot of trips to museums, exhibitions, and the Holocaust Museum.
Mm-hmm.
Since I wasn't very busy with my businesses, I was a chaperone because they required one parent for 10 kids. So I went to Holocaust Museum. And 2 months later, I was driving her with 3 kids to the swim competition. And they were talking about something, assignment, Second World War. And I said, well, at least you know who is Hitler. And in the car was total silence. And I said, what? You don't know who is Hitler? And all 4 girls, including my daughter, silent. And eventually one said, oh, I remember. Wait a second. Oh, I know. I remember. He invented gas chambers. So my question to you. Yesterday, it was my rabbi had a birthday. So okay. I went to shul. Mostly it was on the Zoom. So my question is, what was the day yesterday?
It was the day yesterday, Yud Dalet Bishvat?
Yes, exactly. But it was also another day, Holocaust Memorial Day.
Uh-huh.
So here is the question. The rabbi, we wish him all the best, blah, blah, blah. Obviously, whatever. But nobody mentioned that yesterday Holocaust Memorial Day. Nobody lit a candle, nobody say a word. And just like my kids, I mean, my kids now, they know a lot because I force them to learn. And like most American, even, and we're talking about Jewish girls in advanced school for gifted and talented. And yesterday in the shul, nobody mentioned yesterday Holocaust Memorial Day. Can you explain what's going on?
Well, you have to. I agree with you. It's rather peculiar that, I mean, today the history is about, let's say, a year ago. That's ancient history. Deep ancient history is 10 years ago. I mean, ask people if they remember 9/11. Most of the, you know, your daughter maybe does a little bit. She was 10. Okay, fine. But we have an extremely superficial and very, very here in the moment existence. People don't know anything beyond right over here. It's very strange. It's very peculiar. When I was a kid growing up, the Holocaust was a big deal. It was like something you really, we had Yom HaShoah. It was a big part of our, you know, it's not. I mean, my daughters now, the kids now do have it. In yeshivas, they do. My daughters are very into it. As a matter of fact, one of my daughters asked me why I'm so obsessed with the Holocaust. I said, what do you mean? She said, she got it from me, she thinks. I said, I'm not obsessed with the Holocaust. But it's true that they read a lot about it and they're very into it. And what can I tell you? It's, I don't have an answer. Generation is very...
Even you don't know. I asked you, and you said, "Oh, it took just one."
But by the way, I don't know what's the Holocaust Memorial Day. I never heard of that. I hate to say.
It was day when the Auschwitz was deliberated.
Oh, yeah. So that I know. I happen to know that because it happens to be my next door neighbor's father-in-law was liberated from Auschwitz. So that I know, but I didn't know it was called Holocaust Memorial Day. I mean, Yom HaShoah is a day in the calendar. Okay, interesting. You're right, it was a day. But one second, Edward, who liberated Auschwitz?
I think Soviets.
That's correct. The Russian tanks were the ones who... That's correct. Yeah. That is correct.
So, Buchenwald was by Brits, I think. I'm not sure, yeah, but...
Okay, but Auschwitz was by Russian. All right, anyway...
But, you know what? I'm applying the schmooze. Like you said, we belittle the word Baruch Hashem. Did you remember the schmooze? You said, Baruch Hashem, like we belittle this word. So the Holocaust become like a big number, 6 million people. What the big deal? It's like 6 billion or 60 billion dollars Bezos have. Who can comprehend it?
You're right.
It's become a little number. It's just a number. It's not real suffering. Or in the distant past, like if you give the multiple choice, well, it happened 50 years ago or 200 years ago. Nobody knows.
I hear. All right. Point well made. And you're right. We have to be aware of it. All right, Edward. Very nice speaking to you. Okay. Very nice. Atzlacha. Thank you. Okay. Yehuda, I'm going to try this again. Let's see if you have the floor. I hope you do. I think you do. Yehuda talking permitted, it says. Can you hear me? Yes.
Hello?
Yes, hi.
I'm here.
Okay.
How are you?
Good.
Okay. I'd like to share for this first. I have a off-topic question.
Sure.
My wife is a teacher in a Jewish school, and she just got a call from someone overseas about a reference for her colleague who is a rabbi in the school. And she doesn't know how to answer the reference questions because he's not an amazing teacher and she hasn't had good experience with him as a leader, as a teacher. And she's not sure if she answers the truth, which means that he won't get a job, or she massages the truth and only avoids hurting persons means that he gets the job and maybe leave the school to be better for everyone.
Okay, so here's the problem. Chafetz Chaim explains that when someone asks you for advice or for a reference, you have a responsibility to that person, meaning I certainly can't lie. And more than that, if I know something, but I know it factually, and I don't tell you, I'm potentially hurting you. Here, let's say you're going to go into business. And I know a fellow is dishonest, but not because I heard, but because I dealt with him and I know he's dishonest. If you ask me about him, I have to tell you why, because if I don't tell you, I'm hurting you. I'm injuring you because I know factually he's dishonest. So again, if I know it for a fact, then I'm supposed to say it. I can't exaggerate. I can only say what I know, and I have to say it exactly in what I know. But again, I have an obligation to you as Ben Adam L'Chaveru, any chesed, to explain. Now, again, oftentimes you have to be very, very careful because many things are subjective. You know, maybe I feel he's not my kind of teacher or it was a bad class or whatever, you know. So you have to make sure that you know these things factually because you're right, you could wrongfully, you know, hurt a person very much. So you have to know it for a fact. But again, if I know something with vadoyas, with absolute veracity, I know it as a fact, and then I have to say it because, again, I have an obligation to do, you know, to say. Now, you should know, this happens a lot with shidduchs. You know, I get all the time, I get calls, you know, for a reference. Can you tell me about this person? So my rule of thumb is I don't say anything. I will not say anything bad because I don't know who I'm dealing with. I don't know who the other person is. I don't know, so I won't say. But if I know you, and I know, let's say, you're calling me about your son, and I know your son, and I know this particular girl is, you know, whatever it may be, I would be obligated to tell you because, in fact, I know that it would be bad for your son or a bad situation, and therefore, I would be obligated. Am I being clear on that?
Yes, I mean, I'm being clear. But then, there's another question of if this teacher stays in the parent school, the school is heading down, and if the teacher moves to the other school, it's good for the current school, but the other school might head in the same direction.
Yeah, so that's not very nice, though. And I want to help this school by hurting the other one. You have to leave those cheshbonos to Hashem. You can't do that. In other words, I don't have a right to say I'm going to damage the other school because I don't want my school to, you know, you can't do that. That's not very nice. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. So is it all thing just the truth? If it's definitely true, obviously true, tell the truth.
Yeah, but again, sure, but right. But it has to be something that you saw yourself, not that you heard from other teachers, not by reputation, something that you saw, you know, factually. You know what I'm saying? Oftentimes, we have impressions and we hear things and we sort of build pictures. But if I had to sell it in a court of law, I really don't have the evidence. In other words, if you ask me to testify, how do I know that? Well, I really don't. Then you can't. Because again, it's not true. If you know, let's say you're a co-teacher and you're in the class and you saw that he really doesn't have good classroom management, he really doesn't have good presentation, whatever, you know factually, then you know it. But if you heard it from some other teacher or from kids or parents complaining, whatever, that's not a fact. That's hearsay. So you have to be very, very careful because, again, you're dealing with a human being, you're dealing with a nefesh, and you have to be very careful. You have an obligation to say what you know factually, but you can't exaggerate an iota. All right?
Okay.
Okay, and before we end, I just want to mention the Shmooze sweepstakes is on. It's the big fundraiser of the year. If you would like a chance to win $100,000, please go to shmooze.com. There are also many fine Shmooze gifts. Any level of donation gets a gift. There's a Shmooze mug. There's a copy. If you're interested in a pre-publication copy of the 10 Really Dumb Mistakes that Very Smart Couples Make, it's a book that I've been writing for many years now, and it's the pre-publication copies are out. I just finished typesetting it, and it'll come out. The actual publication is going to be months later. I'm not sure if it's going to be Art Scroll or Feldheim. It's a little bit of a debate there. But the point is the pre-publication copy is available. It's one of the gifts. There's also a USB with the Musavad 30 Shurim on the first parak of Musil Sharm, also an Apple Watch, also an Apple EarPod Pros as gifts. If you go to the shmooze.com, theshmuz.com, you can see the banner on top. Please go there. Please support the Shmooze. Please avail yourself of it. Also, if you would like to join the Shmooze WhatsApp Chizuk group, 3 or 4 times a week, we send out 2-3 minute very inspirational videos. If you'd like to get them delivered right to your phone, please subscribe to 845-216-9330. Again, just send a please subscribe to 845-216-9330, and we'll put you on the Shmooze WhatsApp Chizuk group. Again, 845-216-9330. I wish you a good Shabbos. Thank you. Hope to see you all next week.